Hi, welcome to the Seriously podcast with me, Testament. Before we get to the main event, I just wanted to let you know about the Seriously website. Check out bbc.co.uk/seriously, and there you can find documentaries to feed the hungriest of appetites and the most curious of minds. If you want to get in touch with us, use the hashtag R4Seriously. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, if you subscribe to Seriously, you get two documentaries from the mighty BBC Radio 4 every week, straight to your listening device. Brilliant, right? Now on with the show.
It was a coffee table book for people who didn't have coffee tables. Yeah, rabbit raising, horseshoeing. Real farmers were not reading the Whole Earth Catalog.
Elliot Weinberger, poet, translator, critic, is looking at a large format book on his kitchen rather than his coffee table at his home in New York City. It's a paperback, but a big, oversized one, with the heft of an old atlas. Its 450 densely printed pages are brittle and yellowing. Its cover is mostly black and sports a photograph of the Earth taken from space. The title, in white letters above, reads The Whole Earth Catalogue. Page after page after page is full of things to buy, things to learn, things to think about, things to dream of.
I think the Whole Earth Catalog was very American and probably couldn't have come from someplace else. First of all, the model is the Sears Roebuck Catalog from the 19th century. And people who lived in rural areas, people who lived on farms, were dependent on this fat catalog that arrived once a year. Secondly, I think that the motto for the United States is really not e pluribus unum, but it's do it yourself.
Elliot Weinberger was 19 when he first saw the catalog.
Chainsaws. I mean, I enjoyed the Whole Earth Catalog, but it wasn't that important to me because, after all, I was a kid in Manhattan, so I didn't really need a chainsaw.
Compared to many of the other countercultural publications of the period, it's not psychedelic, especially. It's right. Not sensual. It's not bawdy in any way.
Yeah, there's this kind of Calvinism to it, I mean, which is very American. I mean, this is sort of like, you know, the 1968 manual for pilgrims.
I've brought along my producer's father's copy of the catalogue as a memory prompt to remind Elliot of what he once knew. No one in this program still has their own copy of the catalogue. It was published from 1968 to 1971 and was a disposable book, intentionally so. New editions were published up to five times a year, each one going out of date, like a telephone directory or, in today's world, a non-updated website. It was a disposable book, but its makers had high hopes for it. The catalogue's subtitle was Access to Tools, and with these tools, among them, fishing rods, organic seeds, chainsaws, hoes, canoes, electronic music machines, and some of the very first personal computers. Stuart Brand, the catalogue's eminence grise and chief compiler, intended its users to change their world. And with that, all of our lives.
I think that oppositional ideology in the United States has always been expressed through consumer choices. So the Whole Earth Catalog was very much that. The consumer items that you need for this alternate kind of life. You know?
The catalog was practical and visionary, offering its readers an opportunity to make real the utopian dreams and projects that many Americans were discussing at the end of the 1960s. Its first edition was mimeographed and just six pages long. Its final edition sold over a million copies. Along the way, it won a prestigious US National Book Award. Its influence can be felt in the work of some of its original readers. Steve Jobs of Apple, Microsoft's Bill Gates. The catalogue was the hippie internet, before the internet existed, and before the hippies, and whatever they became, knew they would have to grow old in a world dominated by a cyberculture that, for good or for bad, they had helped to birth. The Creator has a master plan.
Alongside of this Back to the Land movement, you also have this kind of gee whiz belief in the technological future. And I was thinking about it, I thought that it's because all the people who made the Whole Earth Catalog grew up on the magazines Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, which every month gave you these fantastic 1950s visions of the future where, you know, we'd all have rocket backpacks and we'd be flying around and that sort of thing. So they're completely obsessed with these things like, you know, we're just starting here, you know, it's Back to the Land here in California, but we're also going to have a colony on Mars.
You said you didn't really need this or have a use for this publication because you were in New York. Did it strike you as uncool at the time? Was this a sort of manual for lonely people?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that there's the counterculture has so many different aspects in, let us say, 1968. And I was looking at the Whole Earth Catalog Manifesto for the first issue, where they very clearly say, we are not the New Age people, and we are not the New Left people. Because the New Age people are dubious about technology, and the New Left people, they have a strange way of saying that they're interested in politics and we are completely apolitical. To me, it just seemed like a California thing, you know, so that this was something, you know, California or Woodstock or something like that.
Elliot Weinberger. For the purposes of this investigation, let's say the headquarters of the Eastern U.S. counterculture was the small town of Woodstock in New York State. It's been called a staging post between Greenwich Village and the Great American Wilderness. The town lent its name to the famous 1969 Rock Festival, which took place on a farm some miles away, but has also collected some of its survivors. It's a semi-mystical refuge for refuseniks and free spirits. You come into Woodstock on the Levon Helm Memorial Highway, named after the band drummer and vocalist, and you can leave via Strebel Road, where Bob Dylan crashed his motorbike in 1966. Dylan and the band made the Basement Tapes, their own catalogue of the earth, if you like, in a house near Woodstock. And the town still has a hippie-ish feel. There are grey hairs and old ponytails in the coffee shops on Main Street. And everyone I asked remembered the Whole Earth Catalogue. The town library, however, has chosen not to. It sent its copy, the librarian told me, to be pulped for landfill a while back. I came to see one old grey hair in particular. His is near white, in fact, and superbly leonine. At work in the upstairs room of a shop selling dream catchers and other hippie trinkets was long-term local resident Ed Sanders. Back in the early 1960s, Ed started a famous avant-garde journal, as well as the Peace Eye bookstore on Manhattan's Lower East Side. He co-founded a radical band called The Thugs and attempted to exorcise the Pentagon as a protest against the Vietnam War. He headed north to the Blue Stone Creeks of Woodstock in 1973. There he writes, archives the work of friends, and campaigns tirelessly on environmental issues. Ed didn't want to talk at first. He has a snuffle. But he came around, and he's worth listening to. He's his own catalogue of the times. What was the world that the Whole Earth catalogue was coming into and tried to encapsulate, I asked him.
Hi there.
Ed knew then,
nice to meet you.
And he remembers now.
Chairs. Yeah, pull up the chair. Oh, yeah, the last Whole Earth catalogue. What year was this? 1967. Is the cover. Huh. And then the first catalog, the fall 68 issue. Wow. Yeah, I remember this. I had a bookstore on Avenue A in 1968, and we sold the catalog there, some, you know, had it out on the shelves. It was a peculiar year. We put on art shows and the books parties, had a party for Abby Hoffman's Revolution for the Hell of It, and had the first underground comic art show in the fall of 1968, featuring R. Crumb and Shelton and a number of other famous underground cartoonists. That was the first one.
It sounds like it was quite a hangout.
It was a hangout, and I had a sign on the front calling it a scrounge lounge, so it became a stop-off point. And then I had a rock band called The Fugs, and since I was also the leader of that, I attracted a good number of musicians who hang out in the store also, you know, people like Donovan and others, Holy Modal Rounders, Country Joe and the Fish, people like that were friends. And we were right next to Tompkins Square Park, so I helped organize from 66 through 68 a summertime free concert series. So I set up the Grateful Dead to play in Janis Joplin, and the Fugs did annual free concerts in the park for 3 years. So there was a percolating era.
Was there an enemy in the air that you were trying to kind of resist with the peace I
stood? Well, war. Vietnam War was like a puking drunk in a phone booth that wouldn't go away while you were trying to party. So the war was the curse of my generation. I helped exorcise the Pentagon in October of 1967 with some San Francisco diggers and filmmaker Shirley Clark, Barbara Rubin. We all chanted out, demons out. And we did elevate it, but we forgot to rotate it because the war went on till 75. So the enemy was militarism and what we felt was imperialism of the United States government and military, both Democrats and Republicans. We learned about the CIA infiltrating the American media. We learned to suspect who had killed John Kennedy. And then Robert Kennedy was killed in June of 68. Martin Luther King was killed under suspicious circumstances in April of 1968. So we were very suspicious of the entire governmental fabric of the United States. So no matter how many tens of thousands of people we turned out for anti-war marches, the war warred onward and nothing. So our generation was determined to party and smoke pot and take psilocybin and psychedelics and paint our faces bright colors and wear Indian beads and wear long hair. And, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, so a guy wearing a necklace would have been impossible in the little town I grew up, but I could sport a necklace and, like Jimi Hendrix, Afghan vests and curved-toed shoes and pantaloons and fancy Carnaby Street shirts from London. And so we thought the primary colors would last for 500 years.
C-I-Man, 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 C-I-Man.
Ed Sanders and the Fugs and their greatest number, CIA Man.
I was a teenager and I was commuting to high school in New York City from New Jersey. And after my first year, I started liberally cutting classes and hanging around, taking walks, but spending a lot of time in bookstores, of which Manhattan used to have about four times as many as it does now.
Luc Sant was born in Belgium and has lived on the east coast of the United States since the early 1960s. He's a writer, a cultural topographer. Two of his books, Low Life, about the urban poor in New York City, and his latest, The Other Paris, offer alternative directories to two of the world's greatest cities. The Whole Earth Catalogue, he says, helped him to understand his new homeland of America.
And this was a big item, and I could never afford to buy it, you know, but I would paw through it and I would take notes, because they didn't care about such things in those days. And it had a strong attraction-repulsion thing for me because I was already at the tender age of 16 or whatever, I was already starting to look down my nose at the hippies, especially the kind of pie-eyed one-worlders, you know, the back to the land types especially. But I was interested in all kinds of esoteric information. And, you know, some of the more far-out things in here I was fascinated by. I was never going to build my own yurt, you know, that was just not in the cards. But there was plenty in here. I'm looking at this, it's just as massive and packed with stuff and filled with surprises, I remember, really. I mean, the fact that they could recommend things about early computer technology, which certainly points the way to Stuart Brand's future career, and occult stuff, and practical means for back-to-the-landers to go about their business, and humble things like Robert's Rules of Order, you know. And then they ran this piece of fiction, which you never get through. I forget what it was called, A.R. Gurney, some kind of Dragon Quest thing ran in the corners of the pages. Oh, you could rent 16mm movies. I could have made so much more use of this had I been an adult with an income and an apartment of my own. But as it was, I was just kind of making guerrilla raids on it as a teenager.
Luke Sant. Woodstock is our East Coast counterculture capital. In Palo Alto, the city just south of San Francisco and the beginning of Silicon Valley, is the capital of cyberculture at the start of the 21st century. Electricity. The Downtown Heritage Walking Tour leads you past the faceless offices of Facebook through eerily quiet and clean streets to the suburban garage where Hewlett and Packard established their global information technology company in 1938, developing a sound oscillator that was used on the soundtrack of Walt Disney's Fantasia.
This is the very first catalog. It's
in his office at Stanford University at Palo Alto in California, Fred Turner is showing us his collection of Whole Earth catalog materials. He's the author of From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and The Rise of Digital Utopianism. And it was Stuart Brand, the catalog's author, who wrote the first review on Amazon of Turner's book when it was published in 2006. Stuart Brand is still active, president of Long Now Foundation, which promotes long-term thinking about the planet, and lives on a houseboat in Sausalito. We approached him to take part in this program, but he politely declined. He has more pressing things to do.
So the first catalog comes out in 68, and it contains a wonderful, wonderful purpose statement in the front. It's actually changed in later editions, but you'll see it on the front. It says, "We are as gods, and we might as well get used to it. So far, remotely done power and glory, as via government, big business, formal education, church, has succeeded to the point where gross defects obscure actual gains. In response to this dilemma and to these gains, a realm of intimate personal power is developing, power of the individual to conduct his own education, find his own inspiration, shape his own environment, and share his adventure with whoever is interested. Tools that aid this process are sought and promoted by the Whole Earth Catalog. What you can see here is a kind of politics of consciousness centered in the individual. Individuals are developing a new ability. We are as gods in that we have invented the atom bomb. We suddenly have a unified highway system. America just won World War II. We have a kind of amazing power. All right, what are we going to do with it? Well, if we're going to be good gods, we need to change our minds, form a new kind of polity, and find tools to do that. And the catalog is a way to do that. You know, if you open up the catalog, you'll find that there are a series of sections. I believe there's 7 or 8. I've forgotten how many. And the first and most important from my perspective is called Understanding Whole Systems. The key to the communalist mode of polity is that you understand that you are part of a system. You know, we joke about the system in the 1960s, right? The system was the man, the enemy. Not for the new communalists. For the new communalists, the system was the great hope. To take the example of a very expensive fishing rod. So there's a $64 fishing rod in there, fine. It's not about becoming a better fisherman. It's about imagining the perfect tool. If it costs $64, it costs $64. Heck, the moonshot cost a whole lot more. It's finding the perfect tool. That's what we need to do. And we need to imagine ourselves being in perfect sync the way that a fly fisherman is with a perfect rod. Imagine yourself in perfect sync with a tool, and through the perfect sync with the tool, being in perfect sync with your fellow citizens. Therein lies the possibility of a new America.
We tend to associate this book with liberalism or the left. In your book, you also discuss its kind of ramifications and embrace by certain elements of a new right.
I think it would be a great mistake to think of the Whole Earth Catalog as a work of the left. I think that's a mistake. And I think more generally, new communalism has been mistaken as a leftward turn. On the contrary, when the new communalists went back to the land, they turned away from politics. And that would seem to be the quintessential left gesture, but I would disagree. I think that the quintessential left gesture, in the sense that we've understood it, would be to form new parties. It was what the new left was doing. The new communalists turned away from that. They turned away from politics. What they turned toward instead was small-scale technology, the politics of consciousness, and buying and selling things, business. The new right's articulation of government as bankrupt precisely echoes the new communalists' articulation that government was bankrupt 30 years earlier.
Are there moments, spots of hope or utopianism that you feel around you these days?
There are moments of hope and utopianism that I feel, but they're not in the counterculture. They're not in the self-centered use of tools to transform our private consciousness. I think that's actually become a new kind of elitism in America, a sort of self-centered, individual-centered elitism. And, you know, Christopher Lash called it the culture of narcissism. I think we're living in the culture of narcissism on steroids. Where I see utopias are actually in very different places. My favorite utopian space is Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco. Glide Memorial is a Methodist, all-affirming church where they took the cross off the wall because they believed that it belonged out in the street with the people. It's a place where you will meet people of all different social classes, all different races, where they serve, I believe it's 3,500 meals a day to the homeless. They run a very large social service organization. If the Whole Earth Catalog is oriented around a kind of ethic of personal reinvention and social reinvention, Glide is oriented around an ethic of care. And that's what I want to see. I want to see an ethic of care in our world, an ethic where we don't just form networks with people like ourselves, but we reach out to people unlike ourselves, and we do things together that build institutions, that build equality, that allow people who are different from one another to work together and see themselves as fundamentally similar. The catalog doesn't do that, but Glide does.
You ready? Okay, go.
There is, as Fred Turner suggests, by nominating the Glide Church of San Francisco, another side or facet to the utopian afterlife of the Whole Earth Catalog. We left Palo Alto and went north to the city. Not to the church, but to the Mission District, a once poor Latino quarter, still rough and ready, but now also showing signs of gentrification. We visited Artists Television Access, one of the great surviving alternative art centers in San Francisco. Inside a beaten-up and happily approachable room full of folding chairs and Indonesian party food, we found an unassuming door, and through it, a rickety staircase, and at the bottom, a bunker basement. That's the command center for the other cinema. It's at once a hovel, a private club, a plotter's den, a church, maybe even an ark for old, not quite obsolescent technologies. Film cans, projectors, editing machines, flyers for events devoted to the insurgent fringes. Installed amongst all the gear were David Cox, an Australian-English writer and filmmaker, and the other cinema's guiding light, Craig Baldwin, wearing a doctor's white coat.
Hello.
And fresh from a dentist.
Sure did.
But those two facts were coincidental. Craig calls this an alt space, an alternative space, a culture jamming scene. For 30 years, he's been in charge of the other cinema, a micro cinema where independent and underground filmmakers from all around the world gather to show their work. Radical documentaries, found footage assemblages, all sorts of weird experimentalism. There's no real money to be made, precious little fame to be accrued. And recently, the venue came within 5 days of being closed down. Why are Craig and his allies so loyal to the place? Is it what he calls the masochism of the margins? Passionate, funny, celebratory? Actually, it feels more like an ongoing and vital exercise in grassroots utopianism. Hunker down to rise above is one of Craig's rallying cries. David is skeptical about the world the Whole Earth Catalogue helped to create, but Craig is more grateful to Stuart Brand.
Born within the seed of the Whole Earth Catalogue is the commercial element. Go out and buy it. There is the do-it-yourself notion, which is the individualist prairie settler model of America.
Communes, of course, you see
communes, which is the trillion. Utopian Children. California idea of the self-sustaining look to nature for your model approach.
But also village self-sustaining.
But there was a split. Some hippies wanted to go in the direction of
that's
technology.
That's what the net's about, though. I'll show you that.
Yeah, and other hippies wanted to reject technology and eschew it. The pro-technology people would eventually form the corporations and look to venture capital and would form an unholy alliance with the cast-off of the military-industrial complex. And that's where you have the now continuing compromise with the state. Because taxpayers underwrote much of what is in the catalogue and what is currently in place.
Well, come on.
They did. Every single innovation was underwritten.
That's Trump change, man. No, that was supported. That's what do you call crowd support?
No, yeah, no, not fans. This. But the internet itself was a taxpayer funded research.
No, the military has.
But that's military is taxpayer.
Fans run it.
Implicit within this is that it's largely white people doing all the innovation.
Yeah.
And that it's largely middle class, affluent
right.
white people. And,
don't complicate it, David. It's true.
Slavoj Žižek would say.
Oh! Okay, go on.
See, every time I mention someone.
Go ahead. Let's go. It's a European philosopher who's trying to cop on West Coast stuff. Just so you know. Go ahead.
He's an internationally renowned, respected Slavoj.
Go ahead. That's fine. Good old Slavo. Bring him around.
Well, what I was going to say is that Slavoj Žižek would argue that. The California ideology is born from the notion that there is an artificial universalism, right? Everyone is free to express their view. Everyone can, you know, we're all free here to, you know, you can be gay, you can be lesbian, but we can't talk about class. It's impossible to talk about class in the United States. Have you noticed? Have you tried talking about
class? We'll leave it here. Delighted that the argument is still going on. It's a testament to the remarkable and enduring power of this extraordinary book that a catalogue of things to buy can, nearly 50 years later, provoke profound questions about our hopes and our dreams, about individualism versus the common good, about the world we live in, and the world we wish to live in.
Thanks for listening to the Seriously podcast. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/seriously.